From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
East Bay, El Cerrito.
West Oakland.
Richmond, California.
I live in Oakland, California. How you doing?
Coming up, we'll go behind the scenes with veterinarians at the Marine Mammal Center.
Even though they're sick and injured and cute, we try to approach them as we would a wild animal because they can be potentially dangerous in terms of biting us.
Then we get our lotus hands ready for some Hindu swing.
Did jazz hands derive from Alapadma, which is the lotus position in Bharatanatyam technique? It's definitely possible.
And we'll meet a musician who can get to know you by the sound of your voice.
When I hear someone on the phone, I can figure out how is the state of mind of that person because I hear the voice through the phone.
Hello? It's Cross Currents. Stay with us.
We start today with another installment in our series on women in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Women are underrepresented in many scientific fields, but there's one branch of biological science that bucks that trend, veterinary science. Women now make up the majority of veterinarians in the United States and fill close to 80% of the seats in vet schools. The Marine Mammal Center in the Marin Headlands is a good example of this trend. The center is a combination emergency hospital, rehab center, and research institute for seals, sea lions, sea otters, whales, dolphins, among other sea creatures. Three quarters of its paid staff and volunteer community are women. KALW's Jen Chien went for a visit and brings back this story.
It's a sunny day at the Marine Mammal Center. The animal pen area is bustling. Seals and sea lions are housed here, one, two, or three at a time, in individual chain link enclosures, each one containing its own small concrete pool. Outside one pen, a group of about five women are gathered around, getting their game plan together.
We're going to start with Boomer and F2, and then we're probably going to have to sneak out and go do Eloise, and then come back and do admits after.
That's Dr. Lorraine Barbosa. She's a veterinarian. Boomer is a young sea lion, about the size of a Labrador retriever. He's hurt. He has cuts and gouges on several areas of his body.
Why don't you pull me some dry gauze off of the cart?
Barbosa squirts an orange liquid into the wounds. A volunteer restrains the sea lion in a kind of kneeling wrestler's stance, straddling the young animal while holding its head firmly against the ground. Most people here, interns, volunteers, vet techs, are well-trained in restraining their charges.
We're very careful with these guys because they are wild animals, so even though they're sick and injured and cute, we try to approach them as we would a wild animal because they can be potentially dangerous in terms of biting us.
What are you doing? Women make up the bulk of the workforce here, about 45 paid staff and an army of 800 volunteers. At any given time, there may be 80 to 100 people at the center, showing school groups and visitors around, doing administrative or research work, or caring for the animals.
We're just going to get everybody in, throw in the fish.
Part of that care is keeping these wild animals from getting too used to humans. All around the pen area, stacks of flat wooden boards with metal handles lean against the fences. People hold these boards in front of their bodies like shields as they approach the animals. Once one has been cornered, a wet towel gets wrapped around its head as a temporary blindfold slash muzzle. Then they go down all in one motion into that wrestler's stance.
And then can you pass me some more gauze? Sorry, little buddy.
But it doesn't always go smoothly.
Please.
Oh,
are you okay?
One of the vet interns trying to look at Boomer's teeth has gotten a bite on her thumb. She goes off to clean her own wound while the rest of the crew finishes up Boomer's exam.
Is it warm?
No.
Satisfied with Boomer's progress, the team lets him go and retreats from the pen. Barbosa started here as an intern herself while she was still in vet school. She works here on an as-needed basis. When she's not nursing sick sea lions back to health, Barbosa cares for dogs and cats at her small animal practice in Santa Rosa. She says there are a lot of similarities between the two kinds of work.
I go and use skills I've learned here on mean yappy chihuahuas back in my small animal practice because I'm like, oh, that's a great way. We restrain them with towels too. Usually not wet towels, but, you know, similar. Yeah, I love it. I feel like I have the best of both worlds.
So it's a great way of combining, I think, thinking about science. Is it combines science with a concern for animal welfare. You know, so we're mixing those two different passions and interests.
That's the Marine Mammal Center's senior scientist, Dr. Francis Gulland. About 20 years ago, the center was looking for a vet to develop a research program around its animal care.
I thought I'd come here for a year and earn enough money to buy a truck and drive to Alaska. And instead, 20 years later, I'm here, still here, and there's just always more research to do.
Right now, she's working on several big ongoing projects, including looking at the effects of harmful algae blooms on marine mammal health and the prevalence of cancer in California sea lions.
1 in 5 of the California sea lions that come into our center and die have cancer, and that's really high prevalence for a wild animal. And we should be concerned because they share a diet with us, they're swimming in the same water as us.
That water contains toxins like DDT and PCBs, which turn up in the blubber of adult California sea lions. They also show up in human tissue. So far, they haven't found a direct connection between water pollution and increased sea lion cancer, but the research is ongoing. Still, Gulland says that veterinary medicine is often dismissed by those in so-called hard science.
I think there's a perception that, and that's what I sort of received as a child, that you're basically, you know, looking after dogs, and that's sort of cute and it's nice, but it's not science. But if you think about it, to repair a fracture involves understanding how bones heal. If you're trying to treat, you know, gastrointestinal disease, you have to understand how the intestines respond to infections and how inflammation works.
Veterinary medicine used to be a male-dominated field, but Gulland's seen a lot of change over the course of her career.
First of all, veterinary school when I was there was mostly men, but now within the vet schools, the majority of vet students are female. And then within the marine mammal community, all the older scientists were male. And now if you go to a conference of marine mammal scientists, it's probably mostly women, even though there's still some of the senior positions are still mostly male. But there's definitely a change.
Okay, so my thoughts are deciding between going ahead and getting her anesthetized now, doing some pre-op like cleaning and x-rays and stuff like that.
Dr. Lorraine Barbosa and her all-female crew have now moved into an exam room. They're preparing to put a sea lion named Eloise under anesthesia so they can check how she's healing from a flipper amputation.
So once you have it all set up, you're going to basically get it pretty nice and snug on there because you're trying to feed a seal, right?
Once Eloise goes under, the crew snaps into quiet, efficient action, getting her quickly onto the table, placing a tube into her mouth, and preparing surgical instruments and medications.
Is she pretty deep? She looks like... I'm going to put her on 2.
One of the women gathered around the operating table is Joelle Sweeney, who's in her last year of vet school. She started here as a volunteer.
It's a dream place for me, and I'd love to come back and work as well.
If she does come back to work here, she'll be following in the footsteps of some strong women scientists. In the Marin Headlands, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
Find more stories from our series on women in STEM at our website, kalw.org, and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now from women in STEM to women in dance.
choreographer Namita Kapoor grew up in the East Bay town of Moraga, dancing jazz, tap, and ballet. She says at the time, there were no dance classes in her surroundings that reflected her Indian heritage. It was when she went to college that she discovered Indian dance, and as she did her research, she discovered a fascinating link between classical Indian dance and American jazz dance. In the 1940s and 50s, theatrical jazz dance legend Jack Cole invented a dance form called Hindu swing, jazz dance that draws on ancient Hindu tradition and form. You may remember this from dance numbers he choreographed in films like the 1955 movie Kismet. Today, Namita Kapoor brings back the form of Jack Cole in a show called Hindu Swing, playing this weekend at ODC in Oakland as part of its Dance and Diaspora series. Kapoor and percussionist Jim Santi Owen, the show's musical director, came by our studios to tell us more. Kapoor started off by telling me about the first time Jack Cole performed Hindu Swing back in the 1930s.
Back in 1937 at the Rainbow Room, he took Bharatanatyam, classical South Indian dance, into the nightclub stage, and he performed it with a live swing band. And it was the first time audiences had ever seen anything like it. And it was coined Hindu Swing. Jack Cole and the famous Hindu Swing material. And from there on, he started getting recognized.
And so, fast forward to today, what drew you to this Hindu swing in particular versus any other kind of dance form that you would have chosen for your performance?
Absolutely. I wanted to find something that I could connect to, not only spiritually, but historically. And I started thinking about, you know, at this stage in my life, having grown up where I did and having studied and spent my life with jazz and tap and all these American art forms, I'm finding now that all of them are connected to my cultural roots. You know, it was really important for me to tell this story about Cole because, one, because a lot of dancers don't know who he is. Two, because my gurus, my dance gurus, have dedicated their lives to inspiring and continuing to educate people about jazz dance and its true spiritual roots, the technique and the material. We see things on TV today like So You Think You Can Dance, and people get this warped perception of jazz being a commercial dance form, where really jazz is, just like jazz music, so much connected to the identity of America, the idea of all these cultures coming together. And that really happened with Jack Cole. So for me, I was able to tap into his Indian connections, even though he did continue to inspire everyone by studying as many different cultural dance forms and integrating them into what we know that jazz dance is.
Yes.
And when you say, you know, this type of dance has a deep spiritual connection for you, can you elaborate on that? What is that spiritual connection and what is it drawing on?
I think for me, it is about going back to the source of Bharatanatyam. Bharatanatyam is a spiritual dance form that is about telling the stories of the gods. And that is 5,000 years old. What it is about Hindu mythology and these stories that help us figure out who we are today in the world. What is our identity based on these mythological themes that are prevalent in classical Indian dance, even though that is not fully apparent in the same gestures and format that is structured in the Indian classical way. I believe that that is definitely still there within the material that we do when we warm up as jazz dancers, when we go through our basic movement patterns, the way we move. It's much more about a feeling. It's not about the extremities of the arms or the legs. It's about the storytelling. And for me, I think that that is what keeps me connected to jazz and keeps me connected to my identity as an American South Asian woman. You know, I feel that I'm able to tap into a little bit of that classical sensibility every time I warm up in a jazz class.
Let's sing it one more time. Da da.
And so tell me about the show. What should people expect?
We have 3 Bharatanatyam dancers, and we have 8 jazz dancers. The whole show will be about Jack Cole. It'll go through the scenes of telling the story, asking the question, what is jazz? It's not what a lot of people thought it might be. And a lot of people who may not know that, hey, did jazz hands derive from Alapadma, which is the lotus position in Bharatanatyam technique? It's definitely possible. So I think the show is about showing that relationship and celebrating it.
Okay. Jim, what's the significance of having live music, at, you know, along with dance in a show like this?
It's huge. I mean, for myself, one of the things that's been fun working with Namita in this project, I think it's a generosity of spirit that you're there not to show how great you are, but you're trying to support something else, and you're trying to create something that there's a dialogue happening. You know, the energy that happens between the music and the dance. Mm. And they're the same thing, especially with Indian percussion. So all the recitation that happens, you know, in the Indian tradition, you have this idea of the rasas, these different moods that are supposed to be created, of eros or of valor or of sorrow, of grief, you know. I know that if I'm going, gitaka gitaka dinada, gitaka dinada, I can visualize this very sexy hip movement. That's like Radha in Radha Krishna dance. That she's being very alluring, or da. I know what that should feel like by watching these dancers.
I want people to come out of the show going, "Oh my God, I had no idea that jazz dance was connected to Indian dance," and you will look at Marilyn Monroe unlike you had ever seen her when you know that Jack Cole, who took all the eyebrows and the lip pouts and the neck turn and the arm with the raised hand in a sharp way, he told Marilyn, he said, when he first came into the room with her, she was trying to look sexy and she looked, you know, really sort of loose and kind of, he said, "That's not sexy. Throw out your hand, make it sharp, put it there." He taught her every, he was behind the camera, watching her, doing everything with her. She wouldn't do a movie without him. And if you look at that now, and if you look at a Bollywood movie now, you'd be kind of surprised to see one next to the other and the influences that come between the two. And so for me, it's getting people to open their eyes to see that Bollywood is also nothing new. And that jazz is something old and not what you thought it is. And that musically, we are, through the music, we're creating a conversation that I think needs to be had and needs to be nurtured into the next stage as we progress.
Those were Namita Kapoor and percussionist Jim Santi Owen talking about the show Hindu Swing, which you can see this weekend at ODC in Oakland, and they've just added a matinee. We'll show you where to get your tickets at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. As we heard, music and movement can be deeply spiritual experiences. Add to that the human voice, which takes us to our next story from our new series, The Spiritual Edge, stories about innovation in belief, belonging, and practice.
I'm a Muslim.
I am a Jewish.
I have no religion.
I'm Christian.
Reform Judaism.
I'm Catholic.
Muslim. Not religious.
Buddhist.
Southern Baptist.
Hindu. Atheist.
Christian.
Agnostic.
Catholic.
The human voice is a demanding instrument. Handling it requires precision and skill, but for composer and musician Sylvia Nakash, it's more than a tool to make pretty sounds. She sees it as a gateway to spiritual growth. Nakash's musical philosophies are influenced by both Western and Eastern traditions. She was born in Argentina and attended Mills College in Oakland before meeting the person who would become her teacher for more than 30 years, Ali Akbar Khan, a great maestro of Indian classical music. Her own music has an ethereal, haunting quality that can transport listeners beyond everyday reality. She teaches students what she calls yoga of the voice. In classes at the California Institute of Integral Studies and at the Vox Mundi Project, an international school that she founded. Her book, Free Your Voice, lays out her philosophy along with original exercises for opening the voice. In this story, we hear from Nakash about how it's possible to spiritually awaken through the voice.
We have tuning forks to create some sounds. To tune the space. I'm Sylvia Nakash. What I am is a musician, composer. So I chant and sing and work specifically with helping people to open their voice. When I hear someone on the phone and I even don't know that person, I can figure out how is the state of mind of that person because I hear the voice through the phone. My book, the publisher insists that it has to be practical. It's about the spirituality behind the voice and the music, but also has 108 practices. Practices that help you to feel free. If you're free, you're relaxed. And if you're free and relaxed, you can open. For example, whispering voices is very, very liberating. Singing to disappear is you do it with a background drone, D-R-O-N-E, voice loved to be accompanied. So I have to become one, no separation, one, yoga. With this particular sound. When I feel comfortable and I know I am in that particular acoustic landscape, I start moving up and down. It's like being alone in a little corner in your home, discovering how one note makes love with the other. And I don't know why my students are crazy about that. They love it. When I realized the power of the drone, and my students are professional singers, have so much problem tuning, and if I put a drone in the back, they can tune. Nobody's out of tune. They just didn't play enough with a drone. So when I met my teacher, Ali Akbar Khan, I start crying. There is a quality of devotion, love in the transmission of the music in the East that I didn't find in so many years of studying in the West. It's about how you render and how you listen and how you slow down and how you serve with the music. That is an experience that I need to share with people. I cannot give you any formula to open the voice of a person because all peoples are different. But I can listen, and I can listen what that voice wants to express. What is that voice requesting? What is the spiritual quality that needs to be liberated? Spirituality for me is about becoming more subtle, moving from gross to subtle. And the more subtle that we can listen, the more subtle that we can become musically, the happiest.
That was Sylvia Nakash. Her story was produced by KALW's Judy Silber. You can find other stories, blogs, and links from The Spiritual Edge at thespiritualedge.org. That's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Isabel Angel, Leela Day, Sandhya Dirks, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daniel Moore, Ted Muldoon, Rachel Vasquez, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Cheehan. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thank you. We are listener-supported public radio. This music is by The Bayonics. They perform Sunday at San Francisco's Union Square as part of Union Square Live, a series of free concerts. This one starts at 2 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.